So this is a new talk for me. Sabrina gave the story this morning how this whole conference came together pretty quickly. I got an email last week from a friend of ours who was going to give the talk, and I'm actually disappointed she's not here because I wanted to see her. So I am Mandy Walls. I am the technical practice manager at Chef, but basically what that means is we have a professional services team that is paratrooper ninja sysadmins that go into all of our customers to help them out with stuff. So we're basically traveling sysadmins for Chef. What that means is I have frequent flyer miles and not a pager. So trade off, right? I'm on the internet everywhere as LNXCHK, Twitter, GitHub, whatever. So why design reviews? I call this sort of like preloading the horror, right? Getting an idea of what is coming over the hill with an incoming project. And over the years, I've been a sysadmin for 17 years, that you really want to have an opportunity when you can to talk about what the project's going to look like before it hits you in the face. And some organizations are better at this than others. And we heard it in the keynote this morning how Google has striven to improve the relationship between all of the folks that are responsible for their operations and the actual product that they have. You hopefully want to have a design review early enough in the process that you have influence. And doing things like going to the development team stand-ups and all those sorts of stuff, sometimes seems kind of boring, right? But it gives you that opportunity to work with the team, get to know everyone if you don't know them already, if you're not closely correlated with them on a regular basis. You want to be able to talk to development, software engineering, before it's too late to make changes to support the long-term operations of a project, right? The development stage is pretty short usually, and then it might live for years and years and years in operations. So you want things to be as smooth and as frictionless as possible. So what you want to maximize your conversation, the opportunities that you have to talk to the team, to product management, to all these folks who have influence over the decisions that get into all of these products. You get a good feel for the important details, and over time, you learn what actually is important, and maybe the things that you thought were important the first time you did it were like, we now handle this as a standard, so we don't have to worry about it. You don't want to get too far into the weeds, like on, well, we're going to put the files in this directory, and it's going to be named this right off the bat. You want to focus on what alleviates the most headaches. So we're setting goals. You can set your goals based on having by layer or maybe by lifecycle points of the application. So things like initial deployment, runtime management, day-to-day operations, releases, upgrades, handling outages, all those things that become part of the lifecycle once a feature or an application gets into day-to-day operations in front of customers. One of the approaches to this is to have a checklist. And if you haven't read the Checklist Manifesto, it's a really good book that discusses how checklists come into play for complex systems. Pilots have checklists before they fly a plane. There's a very specific reason for that. You don't want to forget things. You want to have everything in front of you. So it's a combination maybe of the global requirements you have, specific needs for the new project that's coming on board. It doesn't have to be exhaustive or hit 100% of the things the first time. So I put a sample up if you're interested, just things that occurred in different projects that I worked on over the years that were things that maybe came up to bite you later in the operational life cycle. So the example I'm going to work through sets goals by layer, right? So talking about different components of a complex system and sort of dissolving them into these little snack-sized bits so you can really think about how their individual components affect the operability of the system. So when you write something like this, it's a living document. You're not going to write it once and keep it forever. You write it the first time, make some adjustments. Oh, we got 6 months in and forgot this thing, and oh, it paged somebody on a Saturday morning, and we could have prevented that. It's a living document, a new process that you can put together. So you make changes as you learn, as you launch more projects, as things that seem new and exciting become old hat, right? And they become organizational standards, and everybody's on board with doing them. So if we have like some random application, and it has some stuff in it, and there's like load balancers and like things that are boring, maybe some things that are interesting, and we've got something like front-end load balancers, maybe a web tier, middle layer of load balancers, applications data, maybe there's BI and reporting, because product people want to know what's going on, why, right? And some external services. And you can start to investigate these layer by layer. Different requirements and different components have different things that are going to become trouble, right? Or have the potential to cause more outages, cause more problems, not be as operable as they could be. So some topics then also hit all layers. Things like, what are your timeouts for external requests? What are your health checks look like? What are you actually looking for as far as the operating system versions and things like that? So let's dissolve this random facetious application into bits and pieces. And we're looking for things that are going to maybe be a pain in the neck later. And some things that I picked out because I have been paged in the middle of the night about things that expire, right? So when you load up your system and you build your application out the first time, people get to you via DNS. DNS is an external requirement. You probably buy it from a clearinghouse, and you have to make sure that your FQDN hasn't expired, right? Because that happens. It happens, unfortunately, too often. Same thing with SSL. And being on the hook for maintaining, managing, recording the dates for when those things expire so that you have preloaded in your operations lifecycle when those things need to be recorded, renewed, repurchased, so that you're not causing an outage by not being ready for them. So one of my favorite gotchas from years of being overly clever with load balancers is the ability to, on modern equipment, send different URLs to different places, right? And suddenly, this one page stops working. Where does it actually go? 80% of the site goes to one pocket of hosts. 5% goes to the legacy application that we just can't get rid of yet. And then there's this other amalgamation of weird bits and pieces that live somewhere else that hold like these special things that we put into the load balancer. So sophisticated load balancing equipment lets you do all this stuff. It's super awesome when you need it. And over the life cycle of your application, it becomes harder and harder to maintain what the actual intent was for keeping all of these bits and pieces separated. And it's also very common to leave things to rot on the vine. And they just sit there forever. And nobody ever remembers what happens. So migrations and other requirements become more difficult when you want to adjust the topology of the system. Well, we have these things, but they only live in this data center, so I have to keep a load balancer there, and all these other weird things that come into play. So then we move back through into the web tier. And things that become harder to maintain over time are not knowing the server type and the version, and not being able to predictably redeploy those systems when the software ages out, right? So maintaining all of the versions, having your infinite software repository, maintaining all these old things sitting around. You also want to record access methods to other tiers, because you may have to go between different portions of the network. There may be firewall requirements. You may actually be transversing your WAN or some other piece of network that you have to be worried about capacity and access controls and things like that. You may have a need for caching so that things don't fall over when you actually deploy, plus all the modules and all their configurations so that you know going in what's actually necessary for the application to run. And back in the day at AOL, we had an HTTP server that we owned, and it's hard to hire, right, for people who already know how to run your weird web server that is built in Tickle, right? I love that. Every time you say tickle, people laugh. It's great. We also had another one that they tried to make us use, which when you pull off the covers, it partially supported HTTP, but didn't actually let you do 301s and 302s. Like, how is that a good idea, right? So making sure the things that you want to use and the things you're being pressured to use are actually going to meet all the requirements. And, you know, politics and all those things aside, you want to do the best thing that you can do for your application and for the users that are going to use it. And I know folks in the room work for large engineering organizations who have the manpower to do this, but please be careful, right? Moving back through into something like your application tier. And application tier has sort of grown to mean all kinds of things. And the customers that I get to work with, so I talk to anywhere from 5 to 10 customers a week, and all the wacky things that they might be doing with all their applications. Maybe they're using COT software, maybe they're using open source software, maybe they've got this weird thing that they built themselves like 5, 6, 7 years ago that they're still sort of dragging around, kicking and screaming. You want to make sure that you have the right versions that the software's still going to run, especially for things like Java. As the containers get more sophisticated or they change or they become more specialized, that everything is ready to go. Another one is outbound services. No one wants to get to the test phase of your initial deploy and say, oh, well, this thing doesn't work because you didn't actually tell me that these application servers need access to the internet because there's an external service that they need to talk to. Also looking at things like user affinity. Over the life cycle of the application, hosts are going to go away. They'll die for whatever reason, or they'll have a hardware failure, or something will happen. And what happens in that situation? Are user sessions abandoned? Do they migrate? Are they replicated into some permanent data store? What's going on there? So that over your maintenance lifecycle, you can replace bits and pieces and components of the system without affecting the overall work. And again, you get things like necessary libraries and their release cycles. When you have large, complex application tier systems, do all of the libraries get released at the same time? Or are you going to be thinking about this library is written by this team and they release on a 2-week cycle, but then it's ingested by this team and they release quarterly, and how all of those things work together? So interesting gotchas that show up on the app tier that are really focused on how you replace hosts when you need to and how you actually do scaling, right? So horizontal scaling means you're going to add another host to the pool. And things that get in the way of that, you want to know in advance because it's going to affect how you can mitigate outages and things like that. Some places use whitelisting between layers, right? For security reasons, and you know, makes people feel better. And but when you're managing an outage and you need to replace hosts, or things load has spiked and you need to add more capacity to the pool, that whitelisting may get in the way, or somebody may forget that it's there and not know what to do to fix why these particular new hosts aren't actually serving the application correctly. You also want to know what changes require restarts. Maybe not everything does, and your ability to manipulate the code, do releases, maintain the actual systems doesn't actually require you to drain traffic or maybe even move the entire request pool to another data center before doing the new load up and restarting. So you may have to, so you want to make sure you know when you add a new host, what happens, and when you do a new release, what has to be restarted. So behind our app tier, we have different kinds of data. And data and storage and all those great things. But you have different kinds of sources for all of the data that you're manipulating and that you're working with. And then, therefore, you have different ability to influence what may be the decisions based on the source of the data. So let's say we're talking about the data for the application. It's being generated by the application. Maybe it's user accounts, or it's preferences related to user accounts that are stored somewhere else, or some kind of customization, those sorts of things, or even content management and publishing systems also would come into play. And if you have an application that's going into multiple geographic locations, you want to know where the master is, right? Especially if not all of your data centers were created equal. If you're not able to do the same amount of, say, backups or network egress out of everywhere, you want to be able to pick a good place for your master to live. Again, if you've got wipe listing or other application authorization, things that are going to affect how you manage your pools over time, you want to record those as well. The scary bits, like SOX or HIPAA or PCI or any of those things that require you to fence off data, partition it in certain ways, firewall it off from the rest of the world, refuse access, all those good things, you want to make sure you have those up front as well in case that you actually have to physically deploy hosts in a different manner. Especially as you have, if you're using something like a hybrid model where you've got some stuff on premise, maybe some things in the cloud, or you've got bursting or things that you're doing so that you can record all that access and necessary pieces there. One of the things that I ask when we're talking about, so we work in configuration management, and one of the things that I end up asking folks about is, are their schemas versioned when they're doing data upgrades on their databases? I find this almost never, but it seems like such a great idea, so that you know for sure when you're talking to the database that the pieces that are in there match the code that is deployed, so that the page doesn't blow up or the application doesn't fail based on a table being missing or a piece of data not being structured the way that the application is assuming it's going to be. Those are really good things to talk to your data engineers, your DBAs about, if you have the ability to sort of front load that conversation. You can also do horrible things to data, right? You can prematurely optimize, or you can go be web scale or use some weird thing that maybe doesn't fit everyone's needs. And you can really get wrapped around the axle trying to front load sharding and other manipulations of the data. Well, you may not need to. You also want to know what data tiers are susceptible to queuing, right? And how that queuing is going to be handled. What you don't want to see is your application tier, all the worker threads filling up, waiting for data or pushing data into another data store. You want to offload that to a queue if you need to, so that your threads come back and are ready for the next customer request. You also want your management of data to be automated, whether it is backups or things that have to be pushed around or compression or some kind of summarizing job that takes all your billions of hits for this week and dissolves them down into some nice little bite-sized report. All of that should be automated, and you want to know where it's going to live and how it's going to be manipulated. Other things you might have in your data tier, you might be importing data from somewhere else. I worked in publishing, so we were importing data from, the most popular module was always horoscopes, which seemed so strange at the time, but you import them in like four languages and people love it. And things that come in with that, you have the schedule, right? So new movie releases, you know that on Thursday morning, all of the schedule for the weekend comes in, including all the new premieres. So you have that data on that schedule, and it has to come in and be right. You want to be able to measure a successful load of the data, wherever it's coming from, whether it's another internal source or an external service that you're paying for. You want to make sure that you know that it's been successful so that no one's calling you and saying, hey, the data didn't load. We've got yesterday's news. What's going on? Can you figure it out? You also want contact information for upstream providers and storage locations and intended size. Because the last thing you want is the disks to fill on your servers because you've got 5 years worth of weird weather data or whatever it might be. These are some of the weirdest things I have ever worked with, quite honestly, is some of the ETL stuff that's out there. And so when I was working on AOL.com, we had pulled in, we had 7 or 8 ETL jobs that came in from different places. And what the actual process was to manipulate this data and like sort of chew through it and put it into MySQL databases, quite frankly, were these weird little Java WAR file things. And I don't know how they got built. They just showed up in the release bucket. And the dev team was like, well, you just run this thing, and it does the thing, and here's the account number. And I was like, it's a WAR file? Like, is it going to log anything? Is it going to tell me what it's doing? And the answer was usually no. And it would they often fail and blow up and do weird things. So you want to make sure that when you have something that your site is dependent upon like that, that it has good, clean stop-start and logs so that you can alert on it, all those good things so that these important pieces of your actual user experience are present. It's really easy to build complex pipelines with ETL, especially if you're taking things from lots of services and munging them together and spitting them back into a place where your servers can get at them. But it makes them very hard to test and very hard to sort of replicate and keep running in long-term production. You may have a data tier that does exporting, right? So we have our data that we generate, we have stuff that we import. We may export stuff for product management and business intelligence and those sorts of folks. And for websites, you get a lot of access logs, stuff like that that goes out. You want to talk about the packaging and scheduling of these things, whether it's a live replicate, sort of read-only database or some other kind of system that your analysts are able to access all the time, or if it's something that is a sort of a dump and export that they get periodically. You also want to know how often to do it and hope that really it should have no impact on production and on the production data store. And this can be pretty heavy, right? So depending on what you're tracking, you may have a lot of third-party services, hopefully, that you use for this that are doing it on the front end, right? So things that are tracking beacons and clicks and stuff like that on the front end rather than having to worry about a lot of them on the back end. Another interesting thing that pops up in sort of modern systems is external APIs and working with them as a consumer. And a lot of this stuff started to move into front-end development. So there are modules and there's queries that run from the browser instead of being in your application tier. But you want to make sure that when you're relying on services you don't own, that you're taking the time to know exactly what's going to happen. Because if the site's down and you get called, it doesn't really matter if it's in the front end, if the page has stopped loading, or if it's in the application tier. So things that you're looking for, you want to make sure you have account names, owners, SLAs of service providers, and contact info for changes or for outages, right? Because if it's not your service, you have to have somebody else you can ask for what's going on and what might go wrong. A way to mitigate these, and you'll see this sometimes, and hopefully all your applications do this sort of stuff too, where you've got the idea of graceful degradation, where there's some kind of module that's going to be populated with external data, and when that data times out or something happens, like the little module just goes away and just kind of sucks up and there's no longer a problem there. So you want to know what your developers are planning to do if the external service is unavailable. What happens to your application if I can't talk to this thing? It shouldn't hang, it shouldn't stop the page from loading, shouldn't stop the rest of the activity from actually happening. You want it to log some message so that you know that there's actually a problem. You can send it to your alerting system to say, hey, whoever's watching this, service X is down. You want to have a reasonable timeout plus a hold down so that you're not making every single request to a dead service maybe you wait a minute and then make the next request, and if it's still down, wait 2 minutes before you make the next request. Ideally, users shouldn't notice. If it's their favorite module, maybe they'll miss it, and they'll be like, where the hell is that thing? Like, it was here before, what happened to it? But the whole rest of the system should still be functioning. Another way to sort of mitigate these is with a red button. And red button, one of the easiest ways to sort of control an application when upstream things are misbehaving. And whether it's a backend service that you actually own, right, it's part of your topology, or it's something external that you're reliant upon, you can have a button here to sort of completely bypass any code stream that is reliant on that down system and continue your application flow. Sometimes you do this with things like feature flags, right? So this is a similar mechanism to what you do for sort of pre-releasing code, right? So you're bypassing an entire new feature with those sorts of things. You can also use it to mitigate outages. So you want the button to be easy to manipulate. Maybe it's in the content management system. Maybe it's in configuration file that can be periodically reread by the application. So the intent is to not have to restart your service because one small component is down, but you also don't want users to notice that there's some instability somewhere in this complex topology. You want it to be a manual process. You've got automatic graceful degradation, like we just talked about, where things have a hold down and they disappear when there's a problem, and red button allows you to have more manual, granular way to manipulate that. It helps you take care of transient errors or even to disable code flow if, say, an API has changed and your release hasn't caught up to making that change. So you can just bypass that component, and when you're ready to release it, turn it back on. Some gotchas for all tiers, things I love. Instantiating a host and finding out that all the host firewalls are on, love that. Especially when I don't have a full list of all the port numbers that I need for my application. I got the obvious ones, like, okay, so we got SSH access, that's great, so step one. Port 80, cool, okay. Yeah, now there's this weird Java thing listening on some random high port that nobody wrote down, and we have to figure out where it is. Application user accounts, do you keep them in the central service, whatever you're using, LDAP, Kerberos, Active Directory, whatever, or are they system local? Or do you use a mismatch where, like, your local ones have user IDs that are replicated by some other user in the centralized service, so you have to make sure you keep things partitioned, because I love that too. What's your logging policy? There's sorts of things that are hopefully organization-wide, where you know that you're using these central logging hosts in these data centers, or you're like, ah, YOLO, man, we don't care, and get rid of all the logs every week. Same with metrics collection. You can have large Rube Goldberg machines for collecting metrics and, you know, rolling them up into data, because they're just information, right? Like, just stuff. Or, you know, maybe ad hoc things, depending on what your organization's doing. So hopefully you have those that you put on every single box that goes into production. And I wish that were universally true. Also things like backups. A lot of the tiers that you work through, there may be no reason to back that stuff up, right? You're in this brave new world where you've got virtual hosts or containers or whatever it is, and if there's a problem, you blow it up, you get rid of it, and you don't have to back all of it up. And then other layers where you want to be very explicit about saying, here's our retention policy, here's what we're legally required to do to meet these compliance and audit things, here's where we're going to put it, here's the contract with Iron Mountain or whoever it is that takes our tapes and then loses them, and whatever else has to happen there. Other things like operating system versions, and I mentioned this briefly before, one of the things that I love about walking into new customer sites is booting up their, logging into a machine and finding out that it's like Red Hat 4. And you're like, whoa, like, you know, the vendor doesn't support this anymore. And they're like, oh, well, we can't migrate. Yeah, right. So knowing that every layer and every tier, everything that you have to work with in production is up to date, right? Because you want not just security components and updates from the vendor, but also the ability to rebuild if one of the hosts fall apart without carrying through gigs and gigs and gigs of old data, old software, all this old stuff. Alerts. One of the first talks I gave professionally was about logging, because at the time at AOL, we were incredibly bad at that, right? And I still have nightmares about this particular error message that popped up in one of my projects on a regular basis. So like every couple of minutes, there'd be like this weird message with just dollar signs in it. And I'm like, well, okay, I guess it could be like how much money we're making off of this, but that seems kind of ridiculous to put in the server log. Anything that hits a production log should tell you information about the state of the system, right? Ideally, you want all that telemetry, all that information to be actionable at some level. If you're gonna waste the disk space on it, you should be able to do something with it, right? So getting systems into production that still have debug logging turned on, no, bad stuff happens there. You don't wanna be woken up in the middle of the night because the disks are full. Stack traces are not alertable events. I know that engineering for every single error code is difficult and it's complex, but at the same time, like I will see it once, and I'm okay seeing it once, and I'm gonna take it, cut, paste, put it in a bug report, and I want you to fix it, right? Because I don't want that stuff in the way of, I can't talk to this host, timed out on this request, this user doesn't exist in the database, or other really important operational errors. So mitigating all of these cases where you can. Hopefully over the course of the life of your application, you get new releases, right? Because everybody loves new stuff. Customers like new things. You want to know what the product owners want and are thinking about for the release schedule. Because not everybody's the same. We work with folks who their teams are allowed to release during the day, and some teams release constantly, right? So the continuous deployment sort of mindset where code goes out as soon as it's ready. I also work with customers who are still doing waterfall, so they're planning for large semi-annual releases. So knowing what the schedule is going to be, when you're allowed to make the changes based on the product's SLA with the customers, they're saying, this product will always be available between 8 and 8, or whatever the case might be. You also want to get all of your operational requirements into the dev cycle. So have that as part of your initial conversation. What happens when I need you to test a security requirement, like new SSL libraries for Heartbleed, or whatever the case might be? How do I tell you, how do I inject that into your dev cycle? Also, service restarts, knowing exactly how often, how to manage what needs to be restarted, what order things should come up in if you have to restart the entire data center for some reason, right? Knowing what all the prereqs are and how things hook together. And whether or not you have to take something like a full zone downtime for an application release. And sometimes it happens. You're gonna drain all of the traffic out of Ashburn, build all of the applications back up with a new release, drain everything back out of San Jose or wherever you are, back into Ashburn, and then rebuild the other data center. So things that cause nightmares, and if you have a release engineer on your team or someone who is very enthusiastic about release engineering, they will tell you that all artifacts should ship production ready. I don't want to manipulate anything after it's been built and tested. If it's coming to me, it's gotten that far down the pipeline, that is what's going into production. So you want everything to ship production ready. You want localized configurations ready in advance, and you want to lean on your config management tools for your other environments. So your artifact is ready, and if engineering, the software developers are still putting configs into their WAR file packages or whatever it is, then those should be the production configs, and you layer on new configs for dev and test. When it gets to production, it goes out and it's production ready. Constantly attaching weird things to dev databases and stuff like that by accident over the years, right? And part of the fault there is that they're actually open in the firewall and no one knew, and that's great. And you're like, why am I getting this lorem ipsum thing on the main page? And it's like, well, we don't know. Software libraries, you want to be able to hopefully set organizational standards. Over time, as your engineering process becomes more mature, you'll have hopefully blessed sets of software that you're going to release. You want to hopefully rely on the OS vendors whenever possible. One of the things that's really easy to get down the rabbit hole on is saying, well, everything we do is so special, and we're snowflakes, and we're going to build everything that we need. And soon you've got 7,000 packages from the OS, and you're rebuilding 800 of them for no apparent reason. You want to pre-check that all your dependencies are available in all repos for all environments, especially if you are deploying into multiple geographic locations. Whatever the syncing mechanism is between those data centers, all of the code that is requirements for your application needs to be in all of those locations. And I have a current customer I'm working with, like their replication mechanism is like they put it on the SAN one day and they wait for the overnight replication to push it across for the next day. And that's beautiful. Like, that's awesome. But at least it gets there. Like, hooray. You want to suppress the urge to rebuild special packages and all these sorts of things so that you're manipulating things in a more granular manner. That way you're not constantly worried about, is our package that we built up to spec with this latest security release or whatever the case might be. Everything that you are focused on here is producing streamlined, repeatable, and reliable installs. Because at some time, like I said, over the life cycle of the application, something's going to go down, and you don't want to be scrounging for the correct versions of any given piece of software. They should be there, and you should know what they are. Splunking through history, things like keeping up with all of your operating system releases, replacing all of your hosts becomes smoother as long as you're no more, usually back one release, right? So keeping things as up to date as possible. You don't want to get into a place where your application is in some kind of distress and digging around trying to build your farm organically because you can't find all the pieces that you want. Performance and tuning is hard to be concise with new projects. If this is a brand new feature, product may have some wild number that they think for, you know, user adoption or what they're expecting the traffic to be. I might be off by a factor of 10 or 100 or even more, right? So I'm not really sure what might happen when you actually get it released. But at the very least, performance regression should be part of the testing process so that you know when you're getting a new release from your engineering team that it's going to perform at least as well as the last release within certain parameters. You want to know in advance what tunables exist and what their indicators are. Well, we know so far when this request is slow or when this times out, let's try tweaking the garbage collection, or you know, you can canary some hosts for certain tunable bits there. Working on outage planning, everyone loves an outage, right? You're looking for sort of known patterns, indicators, as soon as engineering kind of knows what the application behavior ends up being during failure. Is the earlier you know, the more you can be prescriptive about it in your alerts and monitoring. If your development team isn't actually in your current production on-call rotation, they should at least have a shadow on-call that you can call them up when there's a problem with the application that isn't something that operations can fix. Disks are bad, host went down. Sure, we know how to fix that sort of stuff, but like there's this weird error that keeps popping up and we're not sure if it's actually a problem. You want development to take a look at it. You also want to know who's on call from product, right? So I talked about the red button, right? Things that might be red buttoned might be your ad servers are down, right? Who makes the decision to say, okay, let's not try and serve ads right now to preserve the reliability of the site? It's a dream, right? Might happen. So you want to know who to contact for product so that they can maintain communications to executives and other things about what's actually going on with the product there. Other good stuff to think about, the dark art of health checking, right? You want to make sure that the entire stack is working, but you don't want to make it do extra work to do that. It's like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle for health checks for complex systems. You want some check that works its way the whole way through the whole stack for status. And this is something that engineering, you really want them to give to you, right? foo.com/status, right, that has some kind of good report on all of the component systems are working correctly as of some timestamp in the near past. It should return a 200 when everything is good. And as soon as something goes red, it returns an error code so that you can health check off of it and maybe drain traffic off the hosts. These can be super expensive, right? Especially if you're also doing health checks and hold downs from your load balancers and other components in the system. So you want to make sure that you're not overtaxing them, but that what engineering has given you as the health check actually does, in fact, tell you that the system is good. Another thing that might be good to think about when you're sort of, you know, doing initial conversations with engineering is a static failover application or static failover page. And you can do these in load balancing equipment or have it, you know, published to a CDN or whatever, but it gives you a mechanism for not serving up 500s or blanks during downtime, especially for smaller shops where you may not have a very large operations team to help you fix things and it takes longer to coordinate all the fixes. This is like a nice splash page or, hey, we're fixing something and we'll be back, and you see these, right, from different places. So you set it to non-cacheable, show a nice picture, you give everybody a better experience while you're frantically fixing things on the back end. Other team info that's good to get as far in advance as possible, right? You want to know who's who. And, you know, and as far as like things for like organizational theory and stuff like that, like you want to be their friends, right? You want to have a good relationship with these folks so that there's a little bit of personal empathy when there's an outage and there's a problem, or you actually get along and have good goals together. You definitely want your dev team to have some sort of on-call. You want to have a specific intake process for bug reports, feedback, all of your issues, all those crazy log messages, whatever might happen. You want to be able to get invited to the team meetings and actually go occasionally, right? Like, it's on your calendar, and it's like, oh, it's 9:30 on Thursday, and you're like, I'd really just rather go for a coffee, but dial in or show up for the engineering stand-up just to see what's going on. Over time, you learn from experience, right? Infrastructure build-outs should become easier over time, especially if you're working in sort of the same physical locations. You're going to create standards for you and the rest of your team to investigate all these nibbly bits and all these dark corners, and engineering is going to learn over time what's expected, right, for health checks and for damage control and all of these other things that come into play, and hopefully start to front load them into their dev cycle so that minimum viable product has as much of these nice features in it for operations. You're also going to update your checklist periodically. It's a living document. You had the last four launches. Well, we didn't have to worry about these sorts of things, but now we're using this new service, and we want to make sure we capture all the important things about it and its failure conditions and all of that so we can prep for it. So that is my spiel for this morning. 6 minutes early, so you have extra time for coffee. Does anybody have any questions, comments? You want to share some therapy? We can do some talk therapy if you want to, like, share horror stories. Like, there were nodding heads out here, so, like, if you want to share horror stories, that'd be great. So did you have?
So not a horror story, but a question. It sounds like a lot of the work is engaging with across a number of different companies from, like, an initial plan where they have a
That's a hard, soft question. So part of it, I guess, like, the hardest part is, like, having a little bit of interpersonal skills, right? And a little bit of empathy, like, going in, right? And especially because a lot of organizations now are under transition, right? So we heard the Google talk this morning, like, if everyone aspires to that, like, that's a great place to work towards. But the sort of underlying reality is that most organizations are still comparably in the Stone Age, right? And you know, some of the things that you know we do is talk therapy. Like, I want to know your problems. I want you to tell me all of these things that give you pain and what your bottlenecks are and all of these sort of how I can help you have a better life, really. And in most places we go into, like, people are very happy to tell us all their problems, which is, it's super interesting for us, is when we get to see a lot of the trends, which are very reminiscent of everything I've lived through the past 17 years of operations work that I've done. And you can start to have we're kind of known for being, yeah, you share your horror stories and you have a good, you know, hug it out and then you can get down to work. And that's sort of worked for us a lot of places. Even places where we weren't expecting it to work. That there's, you know, that someone just, I want someone to listen to my problems and empathize with me kind of attitude. There's one over here. Yeah. Some of it was, so the question was, you know, when you have I'll sort of boil it down, when you have an old siloed organization and it's sort of indicative of different problems that pop up, especially for operations, how you sort of get beyond that and what it looks like. And for large organizations, like, that transition is super painful. And a lot of times it requires some kind of catastrophic event. At least it did for us at the time. Basically, new CTO came in and said, all right, well, you know, all this stuff that you're doing, stop it, and we're going to do all these new things. And it's traumatic for everyone involved. And while, you know, over time it gets better, or to some degree, that's a really tough way to do it. And there's a lot of other discussion and research that's been done in other industries about how to manage change in a more productive manner. And some of the things that we see work better in organizations now, where is a lot of what was talked about earlier with groups having similar goals and sort of making sure that you're able to realign along these paths towards those goals, but also having enough buy-in and influence high enough in your org chart to say, what you ultimately want to be able to have is someone who's rewarding the good behavior. And sometimes you have to go, depending on how high your org chart is, you have to go pretty far up to get to a place where you can actually do that. And so that's one of the things I've lived through that has been really, really strange. You get to know more of your management chain than you thought you needed to. And if you are sort of the genesis of a change or a genesis of a new idea or something that you really want someone to do, then you often do have to have those conversations somewhere at a level of influence where they can make change down to the org, but also not too high that they don't really understand what you're talking about. So in a lot of larger organizations that haven't really yet adopted the sort of squashed org chart, right? If you've got a lot of layers, you're going to get eventually to a point where there's a management layer that's super technical and doesn't have too much influence, and then somewhere right above them is folks with more influence, but their technology chops are a little older. And those folks tend to be where you can focus on like having a conversation that's, here's the strategy we're gonna adopt because we feel like it's gonna help us meet these better goals for release time and new features and stability and all these great things, and still have the technical chops to understand what that actually ends up meaning for training and skill sets and rewards and prioritization of work and all those good things. So it looks like it's time for the next talk. So anybody else? I have stickers up front. If you are a sticker collector, feel free to take some stickers and my business card if you'd like to. Otherwise, enjoy your day and thanks for coming.